The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salner & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salner, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now, here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. Got Jim joining us remotely. That's pretty standard these days. But he's got a whole bag full of questions, I'm sure. He's got a question today, I think, from Social Security, from our Social Security-specific website. Most of you are podcast listeners, but we do occasionally get questions in from our helpwithmysocialsecurity.com website. That's obviously from its title, a Social Security specific website. So if you're looking for basic information about Social Security and a whole bunch of Social Security specific questions answered there, that would be the place to go. We do a lot of Social Security on the standard podcast because Social Security is an important part of practically everybody's retirement. So it's a topic near and dear to all retirees' hearts for the most part. You know, there's some people aren't in Social Security, but vast majority of you all are. But we haven't talked about that website for a long time. So if you have family, friends, or yourselves that are looking for more Social Security specific information, that would be one resource that's available that we put up on the web for everyone's enjoyment. Helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, all one word. So Jim, thanks for joining me again today. I'll unmute you so you're ready to go. Anything you want to cover before we dive into our Social Security question of the week?
Well, normally I dive right in, but maybe I'll pause a little and say hi to everybody. This show is going to be a little special. I haven't told you about that. So
oh
this is
gosh.
Going to come as a well, I love surprises, and so will you.
I don't.
So literally, folks, we say this all the time. Chris and I don't, what do you call script? We don't.
I think that's apparent to everyone.
Okay. So I did chat with him for about, 5 minutes before the show and told you that we had a Social Security question, a question a week, and then stuff. But I never told you that today's a special show. So this truly is a surprise for him. And he's probably sweating right about now, wondering if I'm going to put him on the spot. But I think he'll like what I'm about to do. But before that, we will get to a Social Security question of the week, and we will get to...
Well, wait a minute. We're not doing the surprise first?
Oh, no. So this is called a teaser.
Oh, so I have to try to concentrate and answer questions about Social Security while there's some kind of surprise going to be sprung on me later?
It is not a bad surprise. You'll probably be... Trust me, the surprise is not going to live up to the hype.
Okay.
That I can tell
Fine.
You.
I like boring surprises.
Yes, my hype is much better than what the surprise is actually going to be.
Okay.
But we're going to lead with a Social Security question, which kind of ties into the surprise, as you'll see. And then the new question of the week, which kind of had a few twists and turns, but not nearly as many as the other question I answered last week with those amazing twists and turns.
Yeah.
But this one made me twist and turn a little bit. I think I got what is going on here, but I'm not 100% sure. But anyways, that's about it. I did want to say one thing. Chris says the norm is that I am usually in my remote studio, which is my house.
It's become the norm.
That's usually on Fridays. I was in the office on Tuesdays.
Yeah.
So I do record the EDU show in the office, in the attic, which Chris calls the penthouse suite. Mm-hmm. But next week, I will not, in case you didn't know, I probably won't be in the office any day next week because I'm attending the AICPA meeting remotely from Vegas. Well, I'll be in Colorado. It's being broadcast from Vegas. So I'll be attending classes throughout the day and then working in between. And I just think it'll be easier to stay home because the first class starts at, I think, 7 o'clock our time or 8 o'clock. It's just going to be easier, I think, for me to stay home on Tuesday rather than going into the office.
Okay.
But I was telling Andrew, I wish I actually went in person now instead of doing it online. I signed up online because I thought I didn't want to deal with flying and all that because I'm doing an awful lot of it right now. But I kind of miss not being there in person. Go into symposiums, folks, and any young financial planner or older financial planner who's listening to the show, I really encourage you to go and try to go in person. You learn more, seriously, networking with people there sometimes than actually listening to what the presenters are talking about. And I think you would agree with that.
Yeah. Lunch and break time are very valuable.
Exactly. Lunch and break time where you can network and meet people and talk. I'm going to miss that aspect of it. But a couple of really, really good classes. You know me, lately I've been geeking out on estate planning. Mm-hmm. So I'm taking some pretty advanced estate planning courses. I'm looking forward to it. I'm not going to know half of what they're saying, but the only way you learn is to sit there and listen and study. So I don't know why I'm getting into estate planning all of a sudden, but I'm going to geek out on a couple of those estate planning courses for sure.
Good.
Okay. What we have now is a Social Security question. This did come into our blog. What we do is I'm going to try, this is something new. It's not the surprise, but when questions come in through helpwithmysocialsecurity.com, they are generally people who find us through a Google search and they're writing a question hoping we'll answer it on that website. Mm-hmm. I kind of elevate them in the scheme of things, if you will, because they don't know about the podcast and they don't know to listen 6 months from now for their answer. So what we do is Chris answers them relatively soon and then turns them into a written post. And he will, I don't know, it's not you. One of our minions posts it, right? I don't know how it's done, but they post it on the blog. Do you post it or does Andrew and
Jacob? It magically happens. I'm not sure who puts it on there.
I don't know who puts it either. Are we sure it's even being put on there?
I think so.
We should check.
Yeah, I'll double check with the minions downstairs to make sure.
Check with the minions there. I mean, you're writing them, so I certainly want them to be posted on helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. But this one comes from helpwithmysocialsecurity.com from a Washington State listener. Mm-hmm. And she clearly needs a little bit of help on this one, Chris. That's why I want to elevate it. Mm-hmm. Okay, she says, "Hi, I am 70. I filed for Social Security in March, just before my BD." I'm guessing that means birthday.
Yeah.
"The Social Security gal is telling me," and I'm not sure if gal is appropriate nowadays, "but the Social Security gal is telling me I can file back 6 months and get a lump sum retro amount." Mm-hmm. And here's where it gets a little confusing, even for me, Chris. She continues. Where did I leave off? Amount. Okay. "She also said I can claim my ex-husband's account past 6 months and get a lump sum retro there. I am not clear if I would convert to my full benefit or not. My ex-husband's amount would be less than half of the amount in my full benefit, which is $3,400. I am very confused. Can you clarify?" I'm not sure if we have enough info there to answer this question, but I'm thrown too by what the Social Security woman is telling her.
There's actually several moving parts in this one. There's lots going on. I can understand why she's confused. A lot of times the simple description they're trying to give you from the rep doesn't kind of embrace everything real clearly. Social Security is confusing, as this question kind of brings forth. The one thing that I didn't hear, which would impact what's going on here, is the ex-husband alive or not? I am guessing, since she made reference to half of his, that he is alive. Therefore, it's a spousal benefit that's in play here, not a survivor benefit, because the survivor benefit would be 100% of what his benefit was if he had passed away, assuming they'd been married more than 10 years. And the fact that the Social Security representative brought it up implies to me that that was the case, because if they weren't married for more than 10 years and they were divorced, then they, you know, there is no attachment, there is no spousal or survivor benefit that she could have claimed back then. So let's wind back to her first comment. She went into file at age 70 and was notified she could backdate her filing or file retroactively 6 months and get a lump sum amount. Sounds really attractive. Who doesn't want this 6 month of payments all in one lump sum? The trade-off is you're going to then forego 4% of your benefit for the rest of your life. So sometimes it makes sense to do that if you have some need for that lump sum now and you're okay with reducing your benefit by 4% for the rest of your life. And sometimes it makes more sense for the longevity protection to have that age 70 benefit be as big as possible. Why is it that way? Well, what they're giving you the ability to do is backdate your application, essentially, up to 6 months. And they do that for people who, it isn't meant as a strategy, really. It's meant as a, ooh, I forgot I meant to go in, or I didn't file in time, or I forgot I turned 70 or whatever. And they allow you some grace and being able to backdate your application. The downside is you start collecting a benefit as if you started it 6 months prior. And anyone who has reached their full retirement age can file retroactively and get this lump sum amount. It is a maximum of 6 months or back to your full retirement age, whichever is less. So for you to get the full 6 month retroactive, you have to be past your full retirement age by 6 months. If your full retirement age was last month, you only get to file retroactively by 1 month. For her, she's well past her age, her full retirement age, which was 66, because if she was 70 in 2022, that means she was born in 1952. Age 66 was the full retirement age for those born in 1952. So that's what they're telling her there. So I would be careful and understand the ramifications of receiving a 4% lower payment for the rest of your life in exchange for this, you know, bounty of 6 months retroactive payment. Might make sense for her. I have no idea. But that's what's going to go on with the benefit. That's the most straightforward piece of her question. The second part, they mention you could claim on the ex-husband's benefit. Well, this is where the rep is kind of probably describing two options for her, not a you can have both of these things kind of a scenario. If she was born in 1952, she actually has been grandfathered in to being able to file a restricted application. And this is where I wish she would have reached out way before now, because she had the ability to file a restricted application for only spousal benefits from age 66. And she could have been collecting half of her ex-husband's full retirement age benefit for 4 years as she waited for her benefit to grow to its maximum size at 70. And because Social Security doesn't reach out to you and point this out and people don't chase you down, you have to discover this strategy on your own by maybe listening to a podcast or reading about it. This is a fabulous strategy that's on the verge of being gone, because those born January 2nd of 1954 and later no longer can do this. You cannot file what's called a restricted application claiming a spousal benefit only and then collecting your own benefit later. That they phased out, but they grandfathered people in with, and they put the cutoff as January 1st of 1954 for birth dates. And she's before that. So I'm guessing that's what the rep was describing. Now, that doesn't mean she gets her own back 6 months and this other thing. I think the rep just knew these rules and she's like blurting out all of these options. Probably was too confusing, because in this particular case, ideally they would have let her go back and claim at 66. They don't do that, unfortunately. I think if the system was fairer, they would say, oh, so sorry to hear you didn't know about this benefit at age 66, but you just left all this money on the table through no fault of your own, because, and I'm speaking as if I were the Social Security system and taking blame for some of this, because we don't educate the population well enough to know about these benefits. We're going to make it up to you by, you know, notifying you that you could have done this at age 66, and here we'll pay you those 4 years of benefits that you missed out on because you didn't know to come in and claim. That's what they should be saying. That's what the system should be doing. You shouldn't have to have inside information or a high level of education to be able to claim the benefits that you're owed. I'll get off my podium or my high horse on this now. She's in a situation, she's 70 now, and has to make a decision on claiming. Claiming 6 months retroactive of a lower benefit, you know, the nice thing about that, claiming her ex-husband's benefit, the half of his, she kind of gets her cake and eats it too. She would then be able to let her own benefit start at 70, getting the full 32% of delayed retirement credits, and get not 6 months of her own benefit, which would reduce the delayed retirement credits, but instead claim that spousal benefit that she should have been collecting since she was 66, most likely. I can't imagine a scenario where she wouldn't have wanted to do that, but she just didn't know. And Social Security didn't reach out to her and tell her. They are now telling her that she could do that retroactively for 6 months, because that's the limit on how far back that they'll go. So that might be the sweet spot. Don't forego the 4% reduction, you know, the 4% credits that they're willing to give you by starting your own benefit at 70. Go ahead and take the 6 month lump sum bonus, but take it on your ex-husband's spousal benefit, and then have your own start at its full age 70 benefit moving forward. I don't know the numbers, so I can't really chime in on which of these approaches makes the most sense. I'm leaning towards that one, because sounds like she's single. She's been waiting this time for Social Security to start at 70, which implies she's been attracted to having the biggest benefit possible, waiting, getting these delayed retirement credits. So here's a way where she could do that and get some lump sum benefit, and have it be essentially what she's going to be doing is retroactively filing a restricted application for spousal benefits only for the 6 months prior to age 70. They'll pay her that in a lump sum, and then they'll turn hers on at 70, and she'll go on her merry way with her maximized Social Security benefit for the rest of her life, no matter how long she lives. That's, I think, the best input I can provide to this. We'll reach out to her. We'll let her know this, and if she, as she listens to this question or reads it, so this will be turned into a blog post. If she has further questions, I'll be happy to follow up with her, but if you're in a similar situation, if you have relatives or friends who are delaying their own benefits and are born before January 2nd of 1954, make absolutely sure they know about this strategy, this restricted application strategy. There might be reasons why they didn't do it or don't qualify, etc., but it needs to be looked into, because this is money that will be left on the table unclaimed if they don't do it. Pretty soon, we're in the last 2 years of this applying, because once we reach January 2nd of 2024, so less than 2 years from now, the door will be closed. In other words, all the people who are grandfathered in now will have reached 70, and then it's a moot point. There's this strategy disappears at that point. So we're at the tail end of it. There's still a few people, and this person is one of them. This person is one of those few people at the tail end of that grandfathering period that could have taken advantage of this. At least she can take advantage of the 6 month retroactive on this, but I wish Social Security would make her whole and backdate it all the way to age 66. That would have been the right thing to do, but the system isn't set up to do that.
All righty. Thank you. I knew you were going to do a good answer for her. And we will turn this into a blog post, listeners, once Chris has a chance to write it all up. And we will make sure from our junior minions that it's actually being posted to the blog post.
I'm pretty sure it is.
Shows you how often I go to that blog post. But I know it's there because every once in a while we get questions at helpwithmysocialsecurity.com. And assuming that all Chris's articles have been posted by our minions, there's some good articles there if anybody ever wants to go check it out or just keep listening to the podcast. Usually the questions he does on the blog, he also covers on the podcast. So yeah. You're not missing anything if you don't go to that website.
But there's a nice kind of an archive. If you're trying to get up to speed on all things Social Security, that would be a place to go and kind of focus and read through a whole ton of old blog posts.
There is. Once I'm done retooling the structure of our firm, longtime listeners know Chris and I are not accepting financial plan or retirement planning clients, until next year. We are still accepting investment management, insurance, and a very, very limited number of tax people. But once I'm done with the retooling, I call it the caterpillar going into the cocoon and the butterfly emerges. Once that's done, I'm going to turn my attention to updating both our websites, our personal firm website and that Social Security blog. But that's unfortunately not high on the agenda for this year. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the new question of the week. We still want to do that. And this one is an IRA question, Chris. Mm-hmm. And it's got a couple of little turns. I think I figured it out. It's not nearly as twisty and turny as last week's question, but it was enough that I thought, let's make this the new question of the week. Okay, it comes from a Georgette. She gives her real name, but we'll call her Georgette. I'm trying to see. She does not give the state, though, she's from, so no idea. Pick a state and you have a 1 in 50 chance of getting it right. Okay, it begins. Hello, guys. I'm obsessed with your podcast. Wow, that's pretty good. It is. I hope she's not obsessed to the point of that woman in the Stephen King novel, Misery.
Well, yeah, let's all hope.
That would be a day.
That's disturbing. Yeah.
If so, go for Chris first.
Thanks. Hope that's not the surprise.
That was Kathy Bates in the movie,
oh,
right?
Oh, I know. She plays a very believable, crazy person.
Yeah, that if you haven't seen or read, I read the book and saw the movie, but my God, that was a twisty, scary movie. Just,
yeah.
Oh, creepy. It just, Okay, it begins. Hello, guys. I'm obsessed with your podcast. It is on in my car all the time. I have an IRA problem, maybe. In March of 2000, so follow this along, Chris, see if you can help me here. But in March of 2000, I contributed $2,000 to a Roth IRA. That was a 1999 contribution. And let me pause there, listeners. Most of you should know you have until the tax filing deadline of the following year to contribute to an IRA for the previous year. Mm-hmm. So she's telling us, listeners, in 2000, she put $2,000 into her IRA, but she called it a 1999 contribution. Mm-hmm. Totally legal. Everybody can do it. And that's what she did. Okay. And at the same time, I put $2,000 into my Roth IRA as a 2000 contribution, year 2000 mm-hmm. contribution.
Okay.
Okay, she lists the company she did it with. It doesn't matter who she did it with. We'll just call it Company X. Okay, she said, I think that was a big mistake and I got bad advice. I'm not sure. I have no idea what advice she was given. She said, I was divorced in 1998, so I was under the income limit for a Roth in 1999. Okay, no harm, no foul there. But I got remarried in May of 2000. And her earnings was too high. She doesn't say this, but I implied it as mm-hmm. I read the rest of her email.
They filed jointly that year, and it turns out for 2000, she didn't qualify to make the contribution to the Roth.
Correct. Mm-hmm. So she writes, I got remarried in May of 2000. Mm-hmm. And had the IRA contribution for 2000 recharacterized mm-hmm. to a contribution IRA. Since my married income was going to be too high to make the Roth contribution. So far, no harm, no foul, folks, okay?
Yep.
She says, I have all the paperwork of what I did. And then I forgot about that account for 5 years. And the investment lost about 75% of its value. I continued to let it sit, hoping for some growth. I decided to get the money out in 2005. It was $1,292.39. Mm-hmm. So let me pause there, folks, and make sure you follow what this woman did. We'll forget the 1999 contribution. No harm, no foul there. She put $2,000 in March of 2000 into a Roth IRA as a 2000 contribution.
Yep.
Perfectly fine. But later she got married and she realized they're going to file a joint return and the combined income of her and her new husband is going to be too much to make a Roth contribution.
Right.
So she got a hold of the custodian and said, can you recharacterize that Roth contribution to a traditional IRA contribution? Mm-hmm. Folks, it's perfectly fine to yep. do. And even you might be saying, oh, recharacterizations aren't allowed anymore on conversions, yeah. not contributions.
Well, and this was back in 2000. So they definitely
could true. And that they were still allowed back there in 2000.
Right.
Okay. So far, folks, she hasn't mm-hmm. had a problem.
Nope.
But as I continue to read on, follow along. So in 2005, folks, her $2,000 contribution was now worth $1,292.39. Mm-hmm. So it had fallen quite a bit. And I continue with what she says. I decided to get the money out in 2005. It was worth $1,292.39. Mm-hmm. And I rolled it over to a Charles Schwab Roth IRA account, forgetting it was mixed with a traditional non-deductible IRA. I never got to report that as a loss. Do I get to report that as a loss? I didn't remember until this year. Let me pause there before I continue reading what she wrote. You can deduct losses. Well, you used to be able to deduct losses in IRAs, but very difficultly. It was a 2% miscellaneous itemized deduction, and you had to close all your IRAs, not just the IRA with the loss in it. So she could have back then had a 2% miscellaneous itemized deduction for what amounted to about an $800-$900 loss. I highly doubt she would have been able to take it. Mm-hmm, it's right. very difficult. However, after the Tax Cuts and Job Acts didn't, and I wish Bob was here, I believe they got rid of the 2% miscellaneous itemized deduction category, didn't they? So now technically you can't deduct IRA losses. Anyways, Google that if you have a chance. I'm pretty sure they got rid of the 2% miscellaneous itemized deduction.
Okay.
I should have looked that up before today's show. Okay. Anyways, Chris will figure that out, folks, for us. Let me continue reading. I'm trying to find the 5498, and I can only find the one for 2000. But it doesn't make any sense to me because it says Roth IRA, with box 4 listing the value as $2,183.63. That was what was left in the account. So now what do I do? The value I rolled over to Schwab was $1,292. Do I do anything? How can I find out if Company X did the paperwork? Do I look for a 5498 from 2000? I know it's not much money, but I don't want to be doing the wrong thing. Am I going to have to pay a penalty? So she said, I'm trying to clean this all up. It's a little too late, but I'm trying to do it. Okay, I'm not going to read the rest of her email. It doesn't have much to do with that.
The Tax Cuts and Job Act did suspend the miscellaneous itemized deductions to the extent they exceeded the 2%. So the one you were referring to is suspended through 2025 with the Tax Cuts and Job Act.
So you essentially right now, folks, cannot deduct the loss in an IRA, but
most people can
very few
anyway.
People
right.
ever
yeah.
could.
Yeah.
You would have the loss would have to be so substantial that it's greater than 2% of your miscellaneous itemized deduction rule. And you have to close every single IRA you own. So it's just, it's not, let me pause there. Roth and traditional are considered separate. So if the loss happened in a traditional, you have to close every single traditional you have. If the loss happened in a Roth, you have to close every single Roth you have to take the loss. It's just not worth it. I read through this several times, Chris, trying to follow what she did. And what I think she did is she actually missed a conversion, is what she did.
I was unclear when she recharacterized if she ended up deducting that or not.
Yeah, let's go through this again, folks. This is how I interpret it. Listener, if I'm wrong, you're going to have to send a clearer email. So she said in 2000, she recharacterized the Roth contribution to a contributory IRA, okay? I don't know what that recharacterization amount was. What it would have been, folks, is the $2,000 she put in plus any growth minus any losses. That's what would have actually been moved back to the traditional or into the traditional IRA. And when you recharacterize, the IRS would consider that IRA contribution as being made on the original day she made the Roth contribution, which was in March. She didn't say the day, but it was March of 2000. So I don't know how much was actually moved, but the amount recharacterized 2000 is always different than the amount that's actually moved. The amount that actually gets moved is the amount you're recharacterizing plus any gain minus any losses. So that's the first thing she did. So to me, that made sense. Okay, in 2000, she recharacterized that amount. She forgot about it for 5 years. And in 2005, she went and looked at the account. And it was worth $1,292.39. That's still a traditional IRA. She told us she recharacterized it in March of 2000 into a traditional IRA. So now it's 2005, and she writes, so I rolled it over to a Charles Schwab Roth account in 2005.
And so just out of clarity from my previous comment, she couldn't have deducted the contribution to the traditional IRA back when she recharacterized it anyway, because if the income was too high to make a Roth, it was way past the deductibility limit on the IRA.
Correct.
I think she had after-tax basis then in that IRA at that time, which her later comment is kind of inconsistent with that. But anyway.
So here's the issue, listener and listeners in general. She never told us if she had other IRAs.
Yeah.
I have no idea.
Yep.
If she never had an IRA, and when she recharacterized the $2,000 she put in March of 2000, she recharacterized it later that year into a traditional IRA. Mm-hmm. She doesn't tell us how much that $2,000 was worth, if it had made anything or lost anything. But do again, keep in mind, the amount you move is different than the amount you're recharacterizing. You have to add gains minus losses.
Yeah, well, the amount that moved is irrelevant because it's still counted as a $2,000 contribution to that traditional IRA.
Correct.
Because when you recharacterize, it's as if the other actions never happened in the first place.
Correct. So. Now, folks, if that was the only IRA she had, that's it. No other IRAs. 100% of that account, Chris and I are assuming, was after-tax dollars. Mm-hmm. Because we do not think she had the ability to deduct it. If she couldn't contribute to a Roth, her income was most likely way too high to deduct it, unless she was not a participant in an employer-sponsored plan. But she doesn't tell us any of that.
Right.
So if that money was never deducted, 5 years later when she looked at it and it's only worth $1,292.39, 5 years later she moved it from company X to Charles Schwab, she clearly says she put it in a Schwab Roth.
Right.
Now, she's bumming that she didn't deduct any losses. We already addressed that part. My concern was when she moved it to a Charles Schwab Roth, she never said I converted it. She said I rolled it over. She's concerned about missing a loss deductibility. I'm concerned if that money was not all 100%, if that was not her only IRA right. in existence at the time, then some of that money she moved issue. Into the Roth, right. Some of that money moved to the Roth would have been taxable
maybe
to
a
her.
Whole bunch of it, maybe nearly all of it, because this is only $1,200 or $1,300 we're talking about. If she's got hundreds of thousands of dollars of other IRA money out there, even in different accounts, that would have been a pro rata conversion she did with most of it being taxable, and maybe she didn't do that correctly.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure
that's
at all.
That's the big out, you know, unknown variable here is what other traditional IRAs does she have out there at the in 2005 when she did this? If this was it, nothing to worry about. This is a non-taxable transfer, rollover from the after-tax basis in the traditional IRA over to the Charles Schwab Roth IRA. If that was it, done deal, nothing to be worried about other than she, you know, seems to be bumming about the $700 of loss that she could have potentially written off, but unlikely that that could have happened anyway. But it's such a small amount, that's water under the bridge, not worth redoing this for a couple hundred dollars of potential tax benefit back in 2000 or 2005. So anyway. Yeah, I agree. The big unknown is what are the other IRA accounts, if any?
That I don't know. And the one thing that does kind of throw me for a loop as I look at this, let me see if I can find box 45498. This is live, folks, even though we're recording it.
And she, unless you read it opposite, her comment was almost like she was thinking that she had a whole bunch of other accounts that were basis, and then this one wasn't, when in fact this part must be basis. And if she had those two mixed up, that means from her comment that you read to me at the beginning of this question, implied she did have other IRA accounts that had a different tax status than this $1,200. And she absolutely missed the pro rata issue all the way back in 2005. Mm-hmm.
So listener, you write in the following sentence, which mm-hmm. I read, she says, I was trying to find the 5498 and the only one I can find is from 2000. But I can't make any sense of it because it says Roth IRA and box 4 lists 2,183.63. So I just Googled what box 4 on a 5498 is. For those who don't know, 5498 is a form that every IRA custodian has to report to the IRS. You get a copy of it, but it's the custodian letting the IRS know the value of your IRA and any money that was put into it. So the IRS can kind of track that on their computer systems and figure out when required minimum distributions begin, if you're taking out enough or if you're not taking any, trying to keep track of Roth money and if you're reporting the taxation issues with early withdrawals correctly. So 5498 is kind of like the rat people out document. They just want to know what you're doing. So she said box 4 had 2,100, I think it was 2,183. It doesn't really matter the exact amount, 2,183. So box 4, listener, is any recharacterizations you did. So they are reporting that you did a $2,183,000 recharacterization in 2000. So you put in $2,000. When you recharacterized, it obviously had grown. And you recharacterized 2,183.
With all that volatility, looks like she was in some tech stocks or something in 2000, and then she lost 75%.
Right.
Yeah.
Then it went from 2,183, and then 5 years later, it was still worth 1,200 something, and that's when she moved it into a Roth. Mm-hmm. If it truly was recharacterized, and this 5498 is indicating it was, if it was recharacterized into a traditional IRA and then you moved it to a Roth, what I think you did is underreported your taxable income 17 years ago. The question is, by how much did you underreport? And do you even want to fix it? It's been 17 years. I can't say yes or no. I know the statute of limitations is gone, but what you would have to do, if that was the only IRA you had and you never deducted it, you're all set. You didn't underreport anything. But if you had other IRAs, especially a large number of dollars in other IRAs, as Chris pointed out, 90, 95, 99% of that $1,200 might have been taxable. And you never reported it from what you're sharing with us. You never reported it on your taxes because you said you rolled it over to a Schwab Roth. But you also told us you recharacterized it from a Roth to a traditional IRA. So when you went from that traditional IRA to a Schwab Roth, that was a conversion and was taxable. So you're not going to be able to deduct the loss because you never even closed your IRA. You can't deduct the loss in an IRA unless you close every single one back then. So you can't do that. I don't know if she, I know what I would do if this was me, but it's totally up to you, listener. If you underreported your income 17 years ago, do you want to fix it for a measly perhaps $1,200 underreporting? That's up to you to decide. Statute of limitations has ran out. Will the IRS catch it? I don't know. But if you want to do the right thing, you might want to fix it. But you got to do a little bit of digging and see if you had other IRAs in existence and things like that. But anyways, I don't want to beat this horse to death. That's the best I could figure out what her situation is. But I did want to let everybody know you can or used to be able to, back when she was doing it, she could have deducted losses in an IRA, but she would have to have closed every single IRA and take it as a 2% miscellaneous itemized deduction.
Yeah.
And I don't think she would have been able to back then at all, especially with that joint filing and the amount of income that they had.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a good one. Interesting one.
Interesting. I hope I got the facts right. There weren't enough facts to be able to get it, but I try to recreate it, if you will. Mm-hmm. All righty. So let's move on to the other questions and our surprise. Mm-hmm. Do you know what June is?
The sixth month of the year.
True. So I guess that would be correct.
June of 22 specifically or June?
No, just June in general, the month of June. The month of June, I'm sure all our listeners know
the
this.
The most popular
you just
month
don't.
To get married?
It is. It is the most popular.
Are you getting
month.
Married?
Oh, hell no.
Oh.
June is National Annuity Awareness Month.
Oh, I did not know that.
I know because I haven't got my gift or my card. And I'm still waiting for it from you.
Apparently.
You must have got my happy National Annuity Awareness Month card, didn't you?
I'll have to go look for that.
You best go home and check your mail.
I'll check it this afternoon when I get there.
June, folks, is National Annuity Awareness Month, according to the very impartial National Association for Fixed Annuities. So you kind of see they're a little bit biased there. But I figure in honor of National Annuity Awareness Month, I kind of picked out all annuity questions and thought we would kind of concentrate on getting these off our docket.
Okay.
So for the rest of today's Q&A show, we're going to do annuity questions. This one comes in from, gives his name, but not his state. Okay. Says, hi, Jim and Chris. I hope you can shed light on this issue. I am aware that an annuity within an IRA is subject to required minimum distributions. However, my question is, what if I am receiving the annuity as lifelong monthly payments? Would the annuity be exempt from RMDs? As you mentioned in previous podcasts, why would anyone want to... As you mentioned in previous podcasts, why anyone would open a redundant IRA annuity? I'm confused on that.
That's a separate topic that unrelated to the first question. I think he's mixed those two together. There's tax deferral benefits of an annuity, and then, of course, there's tax deferral with an IRA. So you were usually talking about a different kind of an annuity, not an annuitized annuity that has got kind of this double tax wrapper. So you're, you know, paying for something essentially in the annuity, a feature that you already get by having it in the IRA. So it's, that's the redundancy, but it really doesn't apply to the first part of his question.
Ah, okay. Thank you for clearing that. So let me just add a little bit to what Chris just said. It is true. An annuity itself, if it was not inside an IRA, during the deferral period, not, in other words, not the period where you're taking income from it, but you're deferring it and allowing it to grow either at a fixed rate or a variable rate where the annuity balance is invested in the stock market via mutual fund-like investments called separate accounts. The annuity grows tax deferred during that phase. Why would you take something that's tax deferred and put it inside an IRA, which is tax deferred? That almost seems counterintuitive. It's like a waste. It's already tax deferred. I agree. But an annuity offers two things that would make it appropriate to be inside an IRA. First, it offers the ability to get a lifetime stream of guaranteed income that you can never outlive and will continue forever until you pass away, or for a stated number of years, depending on how you took the income payments. And some annuities, especially fixed annuities, which is the organization, the National Association of Fixed Annuities, who sponsored the National Annuity Awareness Month, which is June, a fixed annuity will protect principal 100%. So if you're looking to protect principal, especially in a rising interest rate environment. So we often use, and we talked about them before, MIGAs, multi-year guaranteed annuities. We often use them, and we talked about them earlier this year, that interest rates are going to rise this year, bonds are going to go down. If you are a conservative or even moderately conservative investor and you don't like volatility, you may want to move some of your fixed income into a multi-year guaranteed annuity, whether a two-year term, a three-year term. We talked about not going longer than 4 or 5 years, but that would have protected your principal with a bond-like holding. It would have paid a certain amount of interest for the term, hence its bond-like holding. But in a rising interest rate environment, the insurance company would eat the loss of principal, not you. Your principal would be protected. So those are the two times where I would put an annuity inside an IRA if you want income or principal protection. But if you don't want either of those, I think you should never put an annuity inside an IRA. Unless someone knows of a third reason, and I guess before someone says it, a death benefit. You can get an enhanced death benefit on some annuities. And if you were unable to get life insurance, you may want some of the enhanced death benefit options. So I'll concede maybe, just maybe, that might be another time I would put an annuity in an IRA, but I'm not 100% certain on that one. Anyways, anything you want to add to that little divergence before we get back to his question?
No, I think that kind of clarifies his second comment, which, as everyone can see now, isn't really related to the first part.
Okay. So what I think this gentleman has, and he's asking a question, he has an IRA. Inside the IRA is an annuity. Perfectly legal, easy to do, no problem. Chances are the IRA he has is held directly at the insurance company. That's generally how it's done. Right. So you Vanguardians or Schwabians or Fidelians, you generally would have to move the account from those custodians to the insurance company where they would open an IRA for you. And inside that IRA, they would put the annuity you were interested in purchasing. But then he asks, Chris, what are the RMD rules when I am taking income from it? He said monthly income. Annuities will pay monthly, quarterly, or annually. You choose when you turn the income on. Sounds to me like he chose monthly. The answer is, folks and listener, it depends. Depends on what kind of annuity you have. You never told me. If you have a fixed annuity that has been totally annuitized. In other words, or a variable annuity, I apologize. If you have an annuity that has been totally, totally annuitized, you gave up access to the money in the annuity, and instead the insurance company is giving you income for the rest of your life. This gentleman, Chris, made it sound like he's taking monthly income. If you have no access to any type of account value, they call that annuitization. Mm-hmm. They're taking a noun, annuity, and turning it into a verb, an action, annuitization. Chris, what is the RMD on an annuity that has been annuitized? You have no access to an account balance anymore, just income.
If it's been annuitized, they don't waive the RMD, but the annuity payment itself is deemed to be the RMD for that one account. So they essentially cordon that IRA off. This is a unique element where normally they look at all your IRAs and determine things like RMDs from all your IRAs together. They'll actually carve it off to the side essentially and say, this little RMD or this little account over, little, might not be little, this account over here has been annuitized and therefore has its own RMD treatment, and whatever the payment is, we will consider to be the RMD for that one account alone. So it's got its own separate little situation over there. Then all your other IRAs have to play by the same old rules together, consolidated. But that's only if it's been annuitized. And just because he's getting lifetime monthly income doesn't guarantee that's what has happened here.
Exactly. So there's a second type of annuity income benefit. Relatively new phenomenon in the world of annuities, which have been around for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. But in, I want to say, the late 90s or early 2000s, the insurance industry started coming out with a different type of income benefit on an annuity. What they were trying to overcome is what the industry calls the annuity puzzle. Everybody wants lifetime guaranteed income. Nobody wants to buy an annuity. And we can't figure that out. Well, I don't say we as in me, but the industry can't figure out. It makes no sense from a behavioral finance standpoint. We don't know how many times people tell us, oh, I wish I had a pension. All those people who work for the government and have this great pension, or work for this company and have this great pension, they have it so easy. And then we'll tell people, well, you're asset rich, income poor, you can take some of your assets and buy a guaranteed income stream. No, I don't want to do that. That's called the annuity puzzle. So in reference to that, the industry came up with what they called a living benefit. Now, the cynic in me says they did it also to be able to charge exuberant fees and continue taking fees for the rest of your life. That's the cynic in me. And for a good extent, that has proven to be true. But some annuities with living benefits I actually like. And I've disclosed on this podcast, I own one. I've never said the insurance company, I never will. But I showed it to Chris when it was available. Mm-hmm. You remember that, Chris? Yeah, and back. You told me, you're a fool if you don't buy this.
I don't know that. And I did. That.
Well, you didn't necessarily say you're a fool if you don't buy this, but you're like, this is too good to be true. Really? This is how it works? And I bought one of those inside my Roth IRA. So there are some of these annuities with living benefits that I actually liked at the time.
And to prove now, that it was too good to be true, they don't exist. Yeah, they don't exist any longer. They really, it dawned on them, oh, what did we promise?
Exactly. I think it was less than a year after I bought it. You couldn't get in it anymore. Right. They came out with another one with a less beneficial benefit. Right. And then they closed that one a couple of years later and they're just done. They're like, no more. So, and you might be saying, oh, Jim, you only got to keep it for a few years. No. An annuity is a legally binding contract between you and the insurance company. So they cannot close mine. They've offered to buy it out. I've said no. They cannot close it and they're on the hook for it. Okay. So nowadays, I hardly ever use living benefits anymore. But there was a time that I liked them. I just want to share that in open disclosure. Nowadays, the benefits are reduced so much, I don't really care for them compared to what you can get with a single premium media annuity.
I want to add one little tangent to that, not to drag this out too long. But this is a primary example of where you shouldn't be so entrenched in your beliefs that you love or hate, you accept or dismiss something at one point, and then just hold that same opinion for the rest of your life in our business. Maybe, you know, that might be a broader life thing, but we're not going to go there. We'll just say in the area of personal financial planning, let's say you formed your opinion of all annuities at that point, and you thought, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread. Why wouldn't everybody do this? Everybody should do it. Everybody should have it. And you kept that forever. Well, now you'd be embracing stuff that's not nearly as attractive. The market has shifted. You need to be checking back in. You need to assess this all the time. The world changes. The world of financial planning, the world of insurance, the world of investments, the world of everything changes. And you got to stay up to date. And don't be so entrenched and unwilling to change that you stick to something just because it was done a certain way eons ago. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why we've developed the process that we have, is that we weren't so entrenched and tied to the ways that things used to be done or the ways that everyone else thinks about something. If it makes sense to do it differently, embrace it. Look at it critically and assess it and be as objective as possible. Nobody can be perfectly objective. But this is a prime example where the story shifts and changes, and the story today is different than it was before. And you should, you know, as a planner, I'm speaking to those who are current planners or wanting to be planners, don't stay stuck on an opinion you had or something you were taught from even a short time ago. And don't stick to it just because that was what was told to you or that's what you, an opinion you arrived at, and stay unchanged. You've got to be open and absorb information and learn all the time and go with the flow.
Perfect. I agree wholeheartedly on that. Okay, back to his question and what we're trying to teach you today with annuities. There's that second type of annuities that are called a living benefit. There are tons of insurance companies today offering them. And again, I'm not a huge fan of them. I wouldn't necessarily dissuade someone from purchasing them, but I just think they were better years ago. So let's just put that off to the side and look at these annuities and how they work. If his annuitization is a living benefit, quote unquote, annuitization, it works differently. Under a living benefit, the insurance company will say, hey, we are going to limit the amount of income you can take from this. There's two types, a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit and a guaranteed minimum income benefit. There's a big difference between those two. I don't really want to go down that path too deeply here, but generally annuities with a guaranteed minimum income benefit will at some point need to be annuitized. A guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit generally will not need to be annuitized, but they work in very similar fashions. They both limit how much you can take out of the annuity. And as long as you don't take more, they will continue to pay you that amount of money for the rest of your life, no matter how long you live. However, you do not give up access to your money. So let's just say you had $100,000 in there, making this up to follow the logic, and you have an annuity with a guaranteed minimum withdrawal benefit. So you call up the insurance company, you say, I want to take my income out. There'll be a formula that the insurance company will follow, and they'll come back to you and they'll say, okay, you are entitled to $5,000 a year. Again, making these numbers up, folks. So you get your first check for $5,000. Where, Chris, did that $5,000 come from?
Well, they're being so kind as to hand you your own money.
Exactly. They're going to give you $5,000 from your own money. I said there was $100,000 in it. Now all of a sudden there's $95,000 in it. If you have a fixed annuity, that $95,000 won't drop. It might rise, but it will never drop. If you have a variable annuity, that $95,000 might grow back to $100,000 or $120,000, or it might drop if the market's dropping to $75,000. Who knows? In a variable annuity, your account balance goes up and down. In a fixed annuity, your account balance never drops. It might go up depending on what type of interest credits you look to receive. I don't want to get deep into it today. Maybe we'll do an EDU show later on some of these concepts. Because you have access to your money, the IRS says, hey, that $5,000 that came out is a distribution. You still have to figure out your required minimum distribution. So the insurance company will do that for you. And you have to go with what the insurance company says the value of your annuity is, because it's going to be a mixture of your account balance, in my example, $100,000, and the implied benefit of that withdrawal benefit. So there's a calculation the insurance company has to do. It's very complicated, but they will tell you what your RMD for that annuity is. RMD schedules are lower for the most part. If you have one of these annuities and your RMD is greater than the income benefit, you've got a pretty crappy annuity. 99.99% of the time, Chris, the amount of money you're getting as a withdrawal benefit is higher than your income benefit, than your required minimum distribution. Okay, folks? So let's just say in the case that I'm describing, the $5,000 that was paid to him, and let's just say his RMD on that $100,000, let's just say he's 72 now. The initial RMDs right now are about 3.5% for a single person. So maybe his RMD, a single person or a married couple who are not more than 10 years apart in age, it'll be about $3,500, about 3.5% of the $100,000. So the RMD is 3.5. He took out 5. Where's the difference now, Chris, between a withdrawal income benefit where you didn't annuitize and an annuitized income benefit?
Well, the annuitized benefit, distribution counts as the full RMD for that account. But otherwise, if it's not annuitized, like you described, that's going to have to factor into your overall RMD calculation for all of your accounts, and you're going to have to make up any differences through other distributions.
But in this case, folks, the RMD for that annuity is less than the $5,000 he received. It's $1,500 less.
So in this case, that's extra RMD, exactly, that could count against other RMDs, which won't happen with an annuitized. That's what I meant by that segregation thing. That's how I usually describe it to people, is to set that one off to the side if it's annuitized and let it, RMDs are taken care of for that. You can't include that with anything else. When it's not annuitized, then you've got to look at the whole picture again, and you can get kind of excess that you can apply elsewhere, or you have need elsewhere to make up the difference in certain circumstances. I think the case, and I think your point is correct, that most annuities, the guaranteed benefit withdrawal piece that comes out is bigger than the RMD would have been anyway. So it's got a little bit of extra to count towards RMDs you'd have on your other accounts.
Exactly. And that extra in my example, $1,500, can go to reduce the RMDs from other IRAs, right, that person may have. Whereas no payment from a true annuitized IRA, where you don't have access to any of the money, can never go to reduce an RMD on another account. So there could be that little added benefit where you can say, hey, I only needed to take $3,500 out according to the annuity company, but my income benefit was $5,000, $1,500 more. I'm going to use that $1,500 to reduce the RMD of my other IRA by $1,500. That's perfectly fine. Now, a couple other little caveats, since I'm trying to teach people about annuities and not necessarily just answer questions. When you have one of these annuities, you should always, or if you're considering purchasing one of these annuities, you should ask the person who's presenting it to you or the insurance company, if you're working with them direct, is this annuity with the withdrawal benefit? If you're buying an annuitized annuity, you don't even have to ask this. But if you're buying a withdrawal benefit annuity, ask the people, is this annuity RMD friendly? That's the industry verbiage, believe it or not. And what they're saying there is this: if the amount you get in your income benefit is less than the amount you needed to take out as the actual RMD, the insurance company will let you take the RMD out and not pay any penalty or have your income cut. And what do I mean by that? In these withdrawal benefits, folks, you cannot take out more than the amount the insurance company tells you you can take. If you do, so perhaps I shouldn't have said you cannot, you can take it out, but if you do, you will lose some of your guaranteed income benefit. And generally, it works like this. They are going to look at your account balance. And if you take out an additional $5,000, $10,000, $15,000, $20,000, they're going to say, okay, you took out an additional 8% of your account balance. I'm just making that up. If the additional money represents 8% of your account balance, they'll say you took out an additional 8%. We are going to cut all future guaranteed income payments by 8%. Most of them will do a proportional reduction of your income benefit. So do keep that in mind. Even though you purchased it and you have access to the money, it's kind of a red herring, if you ask me, because if you take the money out, your income is going to drop substantially. What if you took half the money out because you need it all of a sudden? Your income benefit drops by half. If you needed that amount of income and now it's going to drop by half, you're in the hole again. So when you buy one of these withdrawal annuities, I always used to tell my clients, and I treat it as myself, you know, I have one. When I put that my money in an deferred annuity with this withdrawal benefit, I wrote that money out of my life. I have no intention of taking anything from that Roth IRA ever, except the guaranteed income payment.
The income, yep.
Because if I take some of that money, my guaranteed income payment gets cut and my income rises 7% every year. I don't take it. That's why I bought that. It was crazy. 7% beginning in year one. So it's just sitting there. I don't look at the account value. I don't care about that. I just know it's going to pay me a tax-free stream of income when I turn it on because it's inside a Roth IRA. I wrote that money out of my life. Here's the problem with these withdrawal benefit annuities. To me, Chris, the only time it really truly matters is if you purchased it and you suffer a catastrophic health issue and living a long time is no longer reasonable or likely, and instead you don't want guaranteed income, you need your money back to go get specialized health care. If you had a single premium immediate annuity, you generally can't do that. You generally can't tell the insurance company, God, I don't need a lifetime stream of income anymore. I would like my money back. Most annuity companies with a annuitized annuity will say, well, you're SOL. There's nothing you can do about that. But there are some annuity companies, and if memory serves me correct, Nationwide is one of them, that have a liquidity feature on an annuitized annuity. Mm-hmm. And at certain points in time, they will allow you to say, hey, give me 30% of whatever I put in that's left. So if you put in $100,000, but they gave you $50,000 out already in distributions, you have quote unquote $50,000 left. It's all pretend money, but you technically have 50% left. And they will give you 30% of that. That's kind of how it works. Those annuities, though, are not considered withdrawal annuities. They're still considered annuitized. So the RMD rules we explained before will apply. But some of those annuities have a liquidity feature, but very few. Outside of that, Chris, buying a withdrawal benefit, you have to put in significantly more money to equal what a single premium immediate annuity or other truly annuitized annuity pays dollar for dollar. Mm-hmm. That's why I don't like them. You got to put so much more money in to get the same amount you would have got out if you put it in a regular annuitized annuity. And the fees on those products are very high. My annuity that I own, folks, all in between the M&E fee, the mortality and expense, M&E, I had it right the first time, the M&E fee, the mortality and expense fee, the quote-unquote rider fee, the fee I'm paying for the guaranteed income benefit, and the fee on the investments because it's a variable annuity, they're taking out over 3% from me. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Absolutely crazy. I don't care. Because when I put my money in, I was washing it away. I said, I don't care about this money. It's going in a Roth. I can figure out every year exactly what I'm getting in income, and it goes up like clockwork, 7% a year. I know exactly what I'm going to get. And because I wrote that money out of my life, I don't care. New withdrawal annuities don't have that rich of a benefit. And when you compare them to what a annuitized annuity pay, they pay a lot less. I don't think that liquidity, Chris, is worth the difference. Now, that's just my own opinion. But also keep in mind, folks, when you buy one of those withdrawal annuities, I want you to die with that balance at zero. Why, Chris?
Because now at least you've gotten all your money back and you're taking some of the insurance company's money.
Exactly. Prior to that, folks, all's what they're doing is giving you your money. That's it. Your money. Now, newer annuities that are withdrawal benefits will continue with the same income stream you were receiving. But while you have money in your account, they're only giving you your money. But they are taking fees from it, especially if it was a broker-sold annuity. You're going to be paying fees of about 3%. And if they're giving you, say, a 5% withdrawal and they're taking 3% of fees, your annuity balance is going to reach zero pretty quickly. I project in my annuity, it will reach zero around 6 to 7 years after I turn the income on. I don't care because they're on the hook of giving me that income forever. Your lower the lower income you get, Chris, dollar for dollar on these withdrawal annuities. If you put $100,000 in a withdrawal annuity and $100,000 in an annuitized annuity, single premium immediate annuity, you get more in the SPIA. Mm-hmm. If your account balance is only going to last 6, 7, 8 years before it reaches zero, and then you're going to lock in those lower annuity payments for the rest of your life, is that liquidity worth it for 8 years? Is the ability to take out whatever money is left in case something goes wrong and you want a life, you don't want a lifetime stream of income anymore? Your life is so short, you just want your money. Is it worth for what could be as little as 7, 8, 9, 10 years worth locking yourself in for less money forever? I don't think it is.
Yeah, those are the choices and dilemmas and trade-offs one has to consider when you're dealing
when
with these products.
Yep.
Yeah, because there's this handing the money over to the insurance company concept that's part of the decision-making process, which isn't the same trade type of trade-off that you have with a more typical investment choice. Thus, a perfect example of why these things are not investments. Right, they're relationships with a company that's making a promise to you, and you get certain things, and you pay for the right to receive those promises. And it's always a give and take. It's always a give and take. Always think of it as anything that benefits you. There's a cost to it to you because you're the one buying or asking for those benefits. If it benefits the insurance company, it costs them. You know, if it it's give and take. And these can be very complicated. That's one of the big challenges, one of the reasons why a lot of people don't like them, and I think fairly justifiably. The insurance companies don't do themselves any benefits, in my opinion, by having these convoluted, confusing relationships and contracts involved. I think they believe it's a benefit, but I think they'd have a lot more people interested in their stuff if it was a lot more straightforward.
If it was more straightforward, exactly. Yeah. People don't understand how they work. And you hit the nail on the head. They're not an investment. But sadly, these annuities with these withdrawal benefits are often sold as investments. You should look at them as an income benefit only. Mm-hmm. That's all it is. It's an income benefit. And you should evaluate it as an income benefit. And you should be willing to part with that money. That's how a pension works. When people work for the federal government or for a union or for the very few private companies left that offer a traditional pension, they pay money into it. They put their own money in, and then the employer or the government or the union is also putting money in. But for the most part, that money is off limits. A lot of them will give them the opportunity to take a lump sum payment instead of a lifetime stream of income. But those are often looked at as income, not investments. These withdrawal annuities are being convoluted, sadly, and they're sold as both. Look, you can have your cake and eat it too. You're going to have access to your money and you're going to have income. And if something happens and the account balance reaches zero, they got to keep paying you. I hate the way they're presented that way. Because the fees are so high and the withdrawal percentage is substantially above the quote-unquote safe 4% for the most part, not all the time, they are designed to reach zero. And you want them to reach zero. I want mine to reach zero because I'm giving the insurance company 3% of its balance every year. I know it, and I'm not losing sleep over it because I'm watching my income benefit rise as long as I keep deferring it. And I'm going to turn it on in a couple more years when I'm 63. And I'm going to start taking money out of that annuity 100% tax-free. It's going to be my fishing trip every year to Alaska, by the way, folks. Nice. So that's what I'm going to have, a tax-free fishing trip to Alaska every year. That's what I'm going to turn that annuity on for. That's why I bought it. Literally, that's why I bought it. I want to fund my hunting and fishing trips every year at 63, which is the original year I was planning on retiring. I've decided I want to work longer than that, but I'm still going to turn the income on, Chris, because I want to go fishing. But I bought that as an income benefit, not an investment. So anyways, we're going to talk more. I have a couple more questions we'll get into on future shows. I think we have to wrap this one up. But it is, quote unquote, National Annuity Awareness Month. And I want to take this month's opportunity to kind of get these annuity questions off docket, but also delve a little bit deeper into them, teach you guys a little bit more about them. Chris and I don't love, nor do we hate them. We just feel they need to be understood. I need to know about them. I need to know what they're doing. I need to know how they're being presented. Where do they help? Where do they hurt? What are the gotchas? Sadly, there are more gotchas than benefits with many of the annuities out there. It's one of the reasons Chris and I prefer the simple, single premium, immediate annuity, the purest, lowest cost form of lifetime income, but sadly, the least utilized of all annuities. If you look at money that goes into single premium immediate annuities, it pales in comparison to the money that goes into variable annuities and fixed indexed annuities. Pales in comparison. Yeah. Why? Not because variable annuities and fixed income annuities are so much better than single premium immediate annuities. Commissions. I'll say it. Yep. Single premium immediate annuities commission very, very, very little and do it once. Variable annuities and fixed income annuities, fixed indexed annuities, I'm sorry, commission substantially more. And either give it all as a massive lump sum of a 6, 7, 8, 9% payout, or usually around a 1% quote unquote trail forever. So if you buy this and keep it open forever until the account balance reaches zero, maybe 10 years during the deferral period and 8 years during the payment period, your broker got a pretty good payment stream from that for 18 years. Because those annuities commission so much more. That's why I feel they're being used so much more. I don't think, Chris, they're truly being used because the income benefit is non-annuitized. They're being sold that way, but I don't think, in fact, I know a lot of the people buying this are never really explained the other side of the ledger. You know, if you put your money in a single premium immediate annuity, you might get more income. So anyways, that's a little bit of my own personal editorial, if you will, but it's the cynic in me. Now, the good news is finally there are quote unquote commission-free versions of these types of annuities. So the broker doesn't earn a commission. They get to levy a fee on top of it. The sad part is, Chris, what are many of those fees? Very high.
Right. Yeah. Well, at least they're more transparent. I'll give them that.
They are more transparent, more obvious, but you're still in the same boat. A lot of advisors, a lot of registered investment advisors, or the firms are registered investment advisory firms, investment advisor representatives, IARs, the quote unquote fiduciaries, they're the ones who sell those. But what they turn around and do is say, hey, I'm not going to earn any money on this at all, putting you in it. But I'm going to charge you my 1% AUM fee because I'm going to help you, quote unquote, manage your account balance. It's a commission by another name.
Yeah, and might be higher than what you otherwise would have paid under the old traditional
structure. Oh, broker sold one. Yeah, exactly.
That's the crazy part.
It's the crazy part. So anyways, do your homework on these. We are not anti-annuity, nor do we love them. We have a love-hate relationship. We understand them, and we know how to evaluate them, and we know where one may be needed. We use it again, longtime listeners know, for minimum dignity floor. And we encourage people to wait as long as possible before buying the income annuity.
Now, wait a minute. Are you saying you're hunting and fishing as part of your minimum dignity floor?
For me?
Just say yes. Because that's the only way that having annuity income makes sense if you're going to follow what you preach.
True. If I follow what I preach, but no, my hunting and fishing, technically it is because that's how I get my food. But no, in my case, if you must know, folks, I don't have much Social Security. I told you guys why. I have very little Social Security benefit. And I don't have a pension benefit. I have precious little lifetime stream of guaranteed income. The annuity that I purchased at the time, I didn't have a lot of money. I only put $16,000 in it. I'll let people know. I didn't have a lot of money back then in, I think I bought it in 2006, 7 or 8, I forget. I didn't have much. So the amount of money I'm going to get for it is going to be precious little of my minimum dignity floor. And I thought, since it's tax-free, I'm just going to use it for my fishing and hunting annual trip. I am going to have to purchase, and you know this, Chris, a very big income annuity when I retire. And I'm prepared to do it. Absolutely. I don't have much lifetime stream of guaranteed income. I'm getting more and more money now because I'm becoming more and more successful and our firm is growing. And by the time I retire and pass the firm on to junior planners, I will take some of the payment for the firm I'm getting and cover my minimum dignity floor. I will practice what I preach, especially if I have a wife, because chances are she is not going to understand retirement planning like I do. And I'm going to want to make sure I'm taking care of her and her needs as easily as possible. I will drink my Kool-Aid when the time comes. But that's why I kind of moved it, Chris, towards the fishing. And I figure if I ever got married, I can say, but honey, this is tax-free. It's just mine. I funded this in 2006. So you got to let me go. It's not hurting you at all. Huh? How's that? I'm preparing for that day.
Let's just make sure she doesn't understand the word fungible. So anyway, we got to wrap things up. This has gone a little long, so I know we only technically got to three questions, but we covered a lot of material today. If you've got your own questions, feel free to send them in, particularly being
for this month, annuity questions month.
Yeah,
right.
If you've got an annuity specific question, this will increase your chances of being chosen as the question of the week. if you adhere to the National Annuity Awareness Month filter we've got going on this month.
We do have four more annuity questions we will answer on future Q&A shows. But yeah, seriously, folks, if you have annuity questions, send them in and I'll try to get them on in the month of June in honor of National Annuity Awareness Month. And I'm patiently waiting for my card from Chris.
Yeah.
And gift. And
mail's
gift.
Haven't you heard? The mail's a little slow these days. So, so if you want to send the email, send it to Jim. Jim@jimhelps.com would be the way to do that. Make sure it's clear in the subject line what you're sending in. And that's a wrap. We'll be back next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.